and welcome to a Co-opticast.
It's a special PAX East edition for 2011.
Yeah, what date? Well, we don't even know what date it is.
It's March 12th, I believe.
Yes, Saturday, March 12th, 2011. I'm Nick. Mike is here. Kat is joining us.
Hello.
And we're going to talk PAX East and what we've seen and what we did. And
our hopes and dreams.
Yes, it's going to be grand. So prepare for an epic journey.
Yes, epic.
So we'll start. We'll start with two quick ones here because if you've watched the site, we did extensive previews of both Brink and Hunted. But Mike got to check it out this morning and weigh in. And so, what'd you think?
I honestly, from what I saw, I liked Hunted a lot more than I liked Brink, just because the co-op play was in full force on Hunted, and playing Brink was like, I think I was saying earlier, it's kind of like playing soccer with six-year-olds. No one really knew how to play it, so everyone was just swarming around. I feel like that will probably get a lot better as it matures, but, you know, in the kind of setting that we had to play it in, even though we were in a dedicated press hour, it was an awful lot of,
yeah.
I'm going to run, I'm going to shoot three or four guys, and then someone's going to kill me, and no one's going to bother reviving me. And then I'm going to have to run all the way back to where I was and die in the same spot, you know, a couple minutes later. I really like the terrain traversal, how you could stick to cover or vault over things without having to throw a bunch of complex controls into it. But yeah, Hunted was pretty rad. Played that with Tally. We rolled through one of the first levels in the game with it, and he managed to get through it. Beat a boss, see more boobies and more butts than I think I had seen in a video game in a long time, and it's pretty fun. Co-op's really strong. It's definitely designed around it. I don't know how much of that would translate over into a single player game, honestly. So that might fall into the Lara Croft Guardian of Light bucket of being a much better game when there's two people playing it.
Yeah, it's weird too because other games like that where they offer a single player, it usually lets you switch who you control on the fly. And in that game, there's actually certain points within the game that
right.
It lets you switch, which is kind of different. So
it was interesting that it lets you do that in the co-op mode. Like you could, two players could actually swap who's playing who. It's a nice feature. I kind of wish that you could maybe just say. You could do like you do in something like Ilo Milo, where you're like, hey, let's switch. And then it flips over. But, you know, it's pretty cool. I definitely like playing as the archer a lot more than I like playing as the melee guy. And not just because whenever she dodged, I saw her butt. But I can't say that wasn't part of it. I gotta be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... So that was this morning during, there was a special press hour where we kind of got to get in and kind of did mad dash around to see a bunch of things. One of the things Kat and I actually went in and then Mike actually saw as well is they had a little short video for Portal 2, a little demo of that.
Oh my god.
And hilarious. And yeah, I think we were all really, you know, surprised or pleasantly surprised at just how funny and deep it is. And, you know, the first game had its things, and it was funny and it was entertaining and stuff, but they really kicked it up a couple levels with Portal 2.
There's multiple characters, and they have some Hollywood voice talent in it now, and it's not that it'd be super distracting. They brought in J.K. Simmons, who, if you don't know him, he played J. Jonah Jameson in the Spider-Man movies. He's been in a lot of Coen Brothers stuff. You'll recognize him when you hear him, but he plays the founder of Aperture Science, Cave Johnson, who, if you ever followed the ARG for the original game, you'd know that name already. But he's in it. They did a lot of voice work. They showed a lot of voice over stuff with the robot, one of the robot companions.
Yeah.
I don't know about you guys, but my personal favorite bit was when it asked you to say Apple.
Yeah.
And the guy in the demo video was like, flashed up a thing and said, press spacebar to say Apple, and you don't do anything, and he keeps like, come on, say Apple. It's a very simple word. Here, I'll use it in a sentence. But you don't have to say the sentence, you just have to say the word. And you tap the spacebar, and you jump. And it sits there and kind of looks at you and says, huh, well, I guess that's good enough. Yeah, that was cracking me up. But yeah, Portal 2, I'm really looking forward to that.
And even above the, the writing and the stuff there, the graphics that they showed off were really impressive. A much bigger scale, while Portal was kind of a cramped kind of a thing. The opening sequence of Portal 2 there, at least for the single player component, had you were in like a little box, basically. Yeah. The box breaks down and you realize you're just like in this cargo container in a sea of cargo containers, and it was pretty impressive, like all around. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah, good plus news. The additional powers that you get with the portal gun, you can do the jumping and the sliding. And
yeah, they had the bouncy goo stuff.
Yeah, right? The bouncy goo.
That was a pretty funny one.
The light bridges that you can.
Yeah, the light bridges. Yeah. So it's a lot more to do, I think, I hope.
Yeah, so that was some good stuff. I also, let's see, I checked out Mortal Kombat during that time, which it seems to have more of a return to its roots. It's not as complex and convoluted and
even brutal.
Yeah, I mean, it's still, it's really brutal, and it's simplified, but the thing I liked, like, the level I played was actually, it was like the original Goro level in the stadium from the first one, but it's, all redone and stuff, and it's impressive. They had the booth set up, actually, with arcade-style cabinets. They had those new... the Mortal Kombat arcade sticks that they're going to sell, the limited editions that are like $180, but they feel really good. They're real clicky and
That seemed to be a pretty big trend this year. A lot of the booths had an arcade cabinet style setup.
Right, and the other one that did was Behemoth. Battle Block.
Both they had a
Castle Crashers.
The best thing I have ever seen was a Castle Crashers arcade machine that had four sets of controls on it. It was pretty incredible,
and it was all hand built. Like the Bohemian guys built it by hand, built the cabinets, and did artwork and everything on it. Actually, carved wood, Castle Crasher guys right on it and stuff. It was really, really nice.
Yeah, I can briefly considered attempting to steal it, but I figured I wouldn't be able to get it back home
or get very far out the door.
Pay off the right people, turn a blind eye, I guess.
Yeah, so you actually got to play Battle Block Theater and finally got to see what some of the co-op in that game is going
to
be like.
I think I finally got to see what Battle Block Theater actually is, because it's been very confusing what they've been releasing. So it's at least in the co-op mode, it is a puzzle platformer. It is, you start at point A, you have to get to point B by flipping switches and jumping over obstacles and solving environmental puzzles. But in co-op, they make it so that depending on how many players there are, the level changes itself. So if there's three players, you might need to use all three players to solve a puzzle. If there's only two, rather than doing like double jumps and stuff, you might just have to have one person jump up high and then use a co-op move to pull the other player up. So that's one of the big things they showed, is that there are... For the easiest examples, there's a block that would be too high to jump onto on your own, so you can jump on your co-op partner's head and then jump up, but now you're too high for him to reach, so you can reach down and extend a hand, grab him, and then pull him up to you. If there's a really large jump that you need to make, you can pick them up and throw them across it, things like that. But this would not be a Behemoth game if it wasn't sadistic, and they basically told me that Battle Block Theater is a game about making friends, but it's also a griefer's paradise. You can, because all of the co-op moves have a visual cue, you're saying, I am extending my hand to help you get through this level, but in mid-animation, as you fling them up, if you let go, you can then boot them and punt guys across the screen, and there are very well-placed spike walls and all sorts of things. You can drop your co-op partner, make them drown, and there's almost instantaneous respawns, and it's very, like, you're not sharing lives or anything. It's very, very funny. But yeah, so the basic objective is in any level you go and You're attempting to get from one end of the level to the other, and in order to unlock the exit gate, you need to collect a certain number of green gems. And the premise of the game is that you're a bunch of characters held captive to perform for an audience, and the objective is to escape. So you can choose to try and free other prisoners with your gems, or you can use them to get out at the end of the level. There's, you know, like in something like Super Meat Boy, where there was the bandage that you'd have to get in every level to complete challenges. There, likewise, in Battle Block Theater, is a ball of yarn somewhere that you have to get.
It's random.
It is. It's very random. It's very behemoth. You know, a lot. There's a lot of Castle Crashers in it, but like all of their other games, everything is very tight. Animation's really fluid. It just oozes personality, and I had a ton of fun. And you know, I honestly had no idea what to expect because they really hadn't talked about what it was. They had shown videos, but they didn't say anything about it. But yeah, you know, and for our audience, it's up to 4-player co-op, and you can do split screen and online, and there's no drop in, drop out, but because of the way the levels scale and change, I don't think they could do that. So that's about the only other thing. Oh, and when you're doing your character select, you actually get to create a character from like pieces. You can pick their body, pick their head.
Oh, interesting.
And I think my personal favorite one is there's a little dude. You can give him a pyramid head that has an all-seeing eye on it. So you're running around with like this giant eyeball on a pyramid head. It was pretty fun. But yeah, I was really stoked after I played it, and especially since I wasn't sure about anything going into it.
Did they happen to say platforms?
XBLA.
Just XBLA.
As far as I know, they're only showing it on XBLA. But you know, it might come to PSN later.
Cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, what else we kind of saw this morning? I guess that was kind of it this morning. Then we started hitting our appointments. We can start with yesterday. We can start with the first one we had, which was one we were most excited for. And maybe it's the one that kind of left sour taste in our mouth, and that was Duke Nukem Forever.
Yeah.
You know, after 12 years and stuff, finally getting to play it was definitely a treat. But it was also disappointing, if you saw the site, to find out that the game doesn't have a co-op mode.
Yeah.
So that was such a staple of the original game for myself and how I really got most of my enjoyment out of it. But it basically came down to Gearbox got the game from 3D Realms, and they basically were just going to finish it. They did not want to add any features to it or anything like that. They just had to polish it, tighten it up, and get it released.
And then they, you know, if what they said was, you know, pretty accurate, they inherited most of a game, and they needed to stitch all the pieces together. And if they wanted to add in, co-op of any kind, they probably would have had to do a significant amount of recoding, rebuilding levels. And after 12 years and how many millions of dollars sunk into this project, I'm pretty sure it was just not even an option on the table for them.
Yeah,
but it's still really depressing to find that out. I was really expecting to hear some news about that.
Yeah,
it wasn't sad.
Yeah, they and I guess they, you know, what multiplayer the game had, they actually farmed out to a different studio to finish up. They didn't talk about any of what's in that, but
I bet it'll be called Duke Match.
Yeah, probably. But the game itself is Duke Nukem. Like it still has the puzzly kind of levels. It's not just your action first person shooter. You have things you have to go around and do and gather and stuff. There's no key cards per se, but like the level we had played was like it started out you were in a buggy, and eventually a buggy runs out of gas, so you have to find gas for it, and you end up in a mine shaft, and you're looking around this mine for the gas, and there's different mine cards and stuff like that. And
it's a physics puzzle.
Yeah, so the physics puzzle that stumped a lot of people is there's this mine cart, and it's got a couple barrels of stuff in it. And you actually have to take the barrels out of the minecart, then you can push the minecart up a hill and get in it, and then ride it over kind of a jump to get to the next area. And then even in the next area, there's a couple other physics puzzles. There's some things you have to shoot down from the ceiling to be able to climb on and almost some platforming elements to jump between ledges and stuff. But I mean, all the guns, I didn't see any new guns, but pretty much every gun in the game was from Duke 3D, and everything from the Devastator to the shotgun, and you know,
The railgun was new.
That's right, I forgot about the railgun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's the assassination moves, which are pretty cool.
Right. And the shrink ray makes a return and stuff like that. So it was still a little unpolished for sure.
And one of the other oddities that we saw were that you were limited to carrying two weapons now.
Yeah, so that's a big change for the game because, you know, like you said, like the weapons are the most fun part of that game. And to limit the player to only two. Though you can still carry the pipe bombs are separate, but it's basically two main guns that you can carry, kind of Halo-esque there.
Well, because you know in Duke 3D, part of the awesome of having the shrink ray was that you would have your machine gun that you'd use for killing everything, but then you'd see a guy and you're like, I'm going to shrink this guy, and it was just kind of a situational thing. You did it as you wanted to, or you'd freeze a guy. You know, guns that don't necessarily kill enemies. But I could really see you putting yourself in a position where you pick up the shrink gun and then some other novelty weapon and completely get owned by the AI because you have poor offense.
Yeah, definitely.
But it was funny, and it did have a reference to one of my favorite things to make references to, and that being pork chop sandwiches.
It did have a pork chop sandwich reference, which was pretty great.
Yeah.
So what else? The other game 2K was showing off was Darkness 2.
Yes.
Which I think surprised both me and Mike. We both got to see a little demo, and they got some hands-on time with it. We both played the original game, and pretty much enjoyed that. And the new game, they kind of changed up the visual style. They went with this graphic novel approach, is kind of what they called it, concept art-ish. You know, you got the hard black outlines, and the...
It looks kind of like Borderlands with richer colors.
Yeah.
You know, it's everything's a little deeper. Everything, like, you can see a little more, some more brush strokes and everything. But I was really impressed with the facial animations in it. You know, everybody was... It was one of the standout pieces of the first one as well. But, you know, you'd get people, like, giving you a knowing look. Or
yeah.
The creepy dude who gets right up in your face and snarls at you.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of... One of the things they really stressed is that they really want to put stuff like right in your face.
Yeah, and so the whole, I mean, like the first game was, you're always from the main character Jackie's perspective, but they really wanted to stress that, and I think the demo they showed off really showcased that well because the demo starts off with you being literally crucified on some boards and being interrogated, and it's just. You definitely just, like, get a little squeamish, and it's just so brutal. And it kind of sets the tone for the rest of the game, because when you do, you start using your darkness powers, so you change it up that each of your snake-like guys are individually controlled. Your left one is used to actually grab things, and the right one is used to slash things, and you can actually target different parts of people's bodies and grab them by. You can grab them by the leg or the arm or the head. And actually hold them up, and then if you want, you can slash them apart. You can grab them and kind of do like a finishing move thing. And
well, and it's also kind of a however you choose to slash something is how it's reflected. So if you grab a guy by one leg and do a vertical slash between his legs down to his head, you split him in half, or you can chop his head off, or chop his foot off, or cut him up down the middle, fling the body at someone else. I think my personal favorite bit was grabbing bits of the environment, impaling people. You could grab car doors off of parked cars and, you know, hold it in front of you, use it as mobile cover, like a makeshift riot shield.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was pretty sweet. Hopefully the rest of the game will stand up to the strength of the demo. I remember the original game started off pretty exciting as well, and then got dull for a bit, then because I was a really big fan of it, but then it would send you into like World War One,
yeah,
and those levels were really weird, yeah. And I didn't really like them that much, but luckily the rest of the game was a lot more fun.
Yeah, So another brutal game that we all saw was Vampire Smile, which is coming to Xbox Live Arcade pretty soon, in the next couple of weeks. And both Mike and Kat got to play that while I talked with the developer. So I don't know if you guys want to talk a little bit about the game itself.
Well, Vampire Smile is the sequel to Dishwasher, The Dead Samurai. It features two-player co-op with two actual players instead of just the mode and the ghost version of Dishwasher. So it's got full co-op, plus they actually announced the kind of mini co-op where you could
BYOB
use...
BYOB co-op.
Yeah. You could use...
Each character's little... They have a little familiar.
Yeah.
And the player, too, when someone is playing the single-player game, player, you know, someone can grab another controller and hop in and control their little familiar. And the way it works out is it's pretty similar to other modes of that type, but they control like a twin-stick shooter. So you move them around the screen with your left stick, and your right stick shoots eye lasers out of, you know, there's like a raven and there's a cat with bat wings, and it will... You'll shoot eye lasers, you can pin enemies in corners and kind of help out, do a little bit of damage. But the real standout was when I was playing as the cat, and James, the developer.
Yeah, James Silva.
So James was playing, and he'd kill a guy, and I'd run over as the cat, and I'd start eating the corpse. And if you eat enough corpses, he'll eventually cough up a hairball, which becomes a healing item for the main player. So, it's not like true co-op, but it is pretty fun. And there is the story mode with two-player full-on co-op.
Yeah, and what's cool about that is he said it's basically, it ends up being, it can be a four-player co-op game in that sense, because you can have the full two-player co-op and then two other people taking controls of this secondary character. So it makes it almost a little more party-like. And I know he said, James had said that one of the reasons he did that is because the game is a pretty hardcore game. It's as much as people want to play it as a button masher to really, he said, you know, to really get good at it, you have to know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So he still wanted to have other people enjoying it in some way. So, I mean, you know, you both played the original. Do you think it's a tighter experience now, like the combo system?
To be perfectly frank, it felt almost exactly the same, and I don't think that that's a bad thing, because I thought the first one was really tight. I learned the ins and outs of the combat. I learned the timing when you had like charge moves, dash moves, and warping around to avoid enemies. Like when Kat and I were playing, I don't think either of us even came close to dying. And Dishwasher is not an easy game, so for us to have that much success kind of speaks to a little bit of muscle memory, I guess.
Yeah, and it was cleaned up quite a bit, but it was still a Dishwasher game, absolutely.
It still looks like a 8th grader's, you know, notebook.
Yeah.
With your art style.
Yeah, he does, the entire game's one guy. He's done the whole thing himself. He told me that he did basically rewrite the whole thing from scratch from the first game, you know, though he did keep some of the stuff around. And he stole some of his girlfriend's artwork for this one, too, as well. But he did, one of the interesting stories he said was he was bored one day, so he just decided to play around and see if he could add a 3D mode to the game, just a red-blue glasses kind of a thing. And he did it, and apparently his producer saw it and said, well, now you got to do the real 3D mode. So the game actually does have 3D support for 3D television. And I didn't find out if it does support the red blue stuff as well still. But he basically, you know, he said to me, he's like, so I had to go out and buy a 3D TV, you know? Expense. So it sounds pretty interesting, but, yeah, it was looking pretty good to me. Like I said, I didn't get to play, but I enjoyed the first game. I'm just glad to see that they, created the story mode that used both characters instead of just that survival kind of arcade.
Oh, yeah, because the survival mode was great fun, and it kind of exacerbated the fact that there was no co-op through the story. It's like, well, co-op works with this gameplay style, so
yeah,
let's do that. But luckily, it sold well enough. I made a game with zombies in it, sold extremely well from what I hear, and, you know, let him make another game.
Yeah, he's doing really well for himself, so that's good. Let's see, what else do we see? Another game that's getting a sequel and an update is Section 8. And I know Kat went and got to see this today, and she was a big fan of the first game, which, you know, she enjoyed, but definitely felt it was missing not only story but co-op, and it looks like they're adding both to the sequel.
Yeah, what the developer told me was that what they did with Section 8, they learned a lot after the fact, after they had developed it, after they'd pushed it out. And as much as this is a sequel, it's also kind of starting over and just putting in all of the things that they felt they needed, like an actual campaign and a full co-op. It's almost like a survival mode, almost. But the campaign is not co-op, and they were thinking they wanted to add it, but it would have been too expensive and too time-consuming at this point. But if they add stuff down the line, they were definitely thinking about it. So hopefully we'll see more co-op with that.
Now, did you see, you know, was there any big new features in it or anything? Or was it just like a lot more of a, you know, tighter experience? Or?
Well, with the first game, basically it was a first-person shooter for the most part, except that you got to call in turrets or vehicles, upgrades, things like that. You also got to pick out your character's loadout as far as what you had for armor and weapons. And this time, you get to customize that. Like, you don't pick the medic class and you're stuck with a shotgun and a pistol or something like that. You get the secondary weapon sort of a deal. So you could be a healing class, but you could also be a sniper and have, like, additional armor. So you could kind of lock down in the back and just support, or you could be a run-and-gun healer, or you could do whatever you want for the most part. So that was a really, really neat experience. And you could change it on the fly, pretty much. But you still purchase the turrets and the vehicles and everything else. And they had a few new vehicles that I noticed, and it looked like they had a lot more weapons to use. I didn't get to play with a whole bunch of them, but there was definitely a lot there. So,
what were they showing off in the demo?
They were showing off the survival mode.
Okay.
So it was 4-player co-op. I was playing with 4 of my peers who we all, for the most part, stayed around the base. It was kind of a protect the base / king of the hill kind of a deal. So you had to keep the enemy away. So you had people supporting from the back. You had people running and gunning, people throwing grenades, and for the most part, it worked really, really well. I don't think we really killed each other that much. We kind of destroyed each other's turrets a few times, but that wasn't intentional. It was like, walk up to it and hit the wrong button. Instead of healing it, you shoot it with a shotgun or something.
What I found interesting, I had played a preview build of that game, and the level they had for the co-op mode in that, there was kind of like this tower in the middle, and the AI was trying to hack some computer in the middle of the tower. It might be in the same level you saw, but what was cool is that the tower had multiple levels in it, so like you could have people on different levels defending. You know, your sniper guy could be on top and covering and pointing out where the guys were coming from.
Yeah.
And then you could have your heavy duty guys kind of guarding that computer right away, and then maybe a utility kind of guy cleaning up the mess. So.
Yeah, the developer said that they would have at launch they would have about 4 maps for that level, and each map has different AI spawn points and different strategies that they'll use and different environments. So sometimes they'll spawn like behind a rock and try to flank you, or sometimes they'll spawn in your own base and you have to figure out how to deal with that.
Well, the thing with Section 8 too has always been the respawn mechanic for the player, in that you drop in from the sky and you control your guy as he drops in the whole way. And there's kind of like this meter. I'm not 100% sure how it works, but there's a meter on the right, and there's a specific time you're supposed to basically hit your it's not a parachute, but hit your brakes, so to speak, to land ideally. And it's just something really tense about that when you especially in the survival mode, when you know you have to get back into battle quickly, and you're trying to pick your spot of where you want to land to help your buddies and stuff out. That I thought worked really well.
Yeah, we played it on easy mode, so when we dropped in, it was, you know, pretty slow pace as far as the AI getting close, but the developer did point out that if more than one person dies at once, it's pretty easy to be overwhelmed, and on the higher levels, that overwhelming happens a lot faster, so it can be a pretty intense experience if you want it to be, or it could be fairly low-key, just kind of hanging out, shooting bad guys.
Cool. So let's see, another game we saw this morning, which I think we both really liked, was Fallen Frontier. And it's by a new studio called Moonshot Studios. And these are a bunch of ex-Halo developers, actually, from Bungie. And the game is a 2D platformer that borrows a lot of elements from... if you ever played Shadow Complex, there's some stuff in there.
Oh, so it's Super Metroid.
Kind of.
It's got a lot of unique elements
to
it, though.
It's a very tactical game. Yeah. It's the best way to describe it. The other thing, it borrows a bit from Bionic Commando in the sense that you have a grappling hook to help you get around faster.
And grab enemies. The grappling hook can tether enemies toward you or toward your allies or just throwing them around if you want.
But this game has a really pretty style. They use... their concept art is actually the art they use for the in-game backgrounds. It's just that the characters themselves, while they're 2D, they're kind of that 2D that's pieced together from a bunch of different things, so you can kind of see the joints of the character and stuff. It's not like one smooth animated character. So because of that, you have like ragdoll physics on all the guys. And Kat and I got to play through a couple levels in co-op. And we found that it was, like I said, it's really tactical in that you would flank enemies and stuff like that. So, like, maybe Kat would be running up and she'd be shotgunning some of the enemies, which would draw them towards her. And I could go around, drop down a few of the levels, and then work back up the other side to flank them. So, instead of like a horizontal flanking maneuver, you're actually flanking vertically, which was pretty different. So. Definitely like that. There's a couple different weapons that we picked up and played with. There's a carbine that I got that you could line up headshots, which was very satisfying. Like I said, you had a shotgun.
I had a shotgun, and I liked the assault rifle a lot, but the shotgun was pretty satisfying until it would overheat if you shot three times in a row, and it was kind of a bummer. But the one saving grace to that is when your shotgun overheats, you can melee attack, which I really appreciated a lot.
Cat likes to hit things. We've determined that.
If you snuck up behind enemies, you could hit them in the back of the head and crumple them pretty well with a nice rabbit punch. So.
So that was a lot of fun, and it's a long ways off yet, too. They said that they're going to really try and get some good story in there, stuff. They have a whole universe that they want to build out for that. So
was it more of a proof of concept then?
I don't think it was a proof of concept. They know what they want to do. They're just not talking about what it is yet. They just wanted to... They're shopping around for a publisher right now. They want to be on every platform. They don't have that yet. So they just want to... I think they just want to prove that, like, look, this is the gameplay style, and this is what we want to do, and this... It works. It works really well. I had said that it reminds me a lot of Abuse from the old PC game.
Yeah.
it feels a lot like that, which is a, you know, a really good game. Back in its day, so I'm really excited, but they're targeting a 2012 release date, so we're not even going to see it this year, sadly. Let's see what else, Mike. You played we all played some Guild Wars 2, but you actually went and got some.
I had a demo with the developers.
Yeah.
Yes. Guild Wars 2. They fully admitted in this demo that they really were kind of uncomfortable with people referring to the first one as an MMO. And it had kind of the structure, but it was so instanced. So the biggest change about Guild Wars 2, I feel, is that the world is now persistent. Rather than finding a party in a town and then going off into an instanced world, the world is a very living, breathing place. It borrows... They wouldn't, you know, say... Of course, they're not going to say that it was influenced by... But Warhammer Online had its notion of something called a public quest, right? It's like there'd be an area that had a constantly shifting objective. So you'd find an area, it would say, hey, here's a place you need to kill 15 guards. And then when you kill the 15 guards, it might spawn stronger guards and then eventually spawn a boss. And then everyone would be rewarded for their participation and... It started a countdown timer and started new. So what Guild Wars 2 does is as you encounter towns and events in the world, it might say, hey, you know, these buildings are on fire. Go grab a bucket and put the fire out. And, you know, you have to at the same time be killing the invaders of the town because they'll keep lighting fires. So you'll fight the fires, save the town, and then, you know, the invaders will go away and then you know, shopkeeps might reopen their stores and come back for a while, and then something else might happen. They'll say, okay, the town's safe, but we just got invaded. We need to build defenses. So you might have a goal to help build, fortify the town, and enemies might show up during the fortification phase, and depending on whether you succeed or fail, it might it could advance to one of several other phases. But the important thing here is that there actually are fail states. So, you know, this town's being overrun, players fail to drive it back, the town gets overrun, and NPCs in that town might be unavailable or driven away. And so they say these events will kind of evolve over the course of several hours. There might be a thing that only lasts 10 minutes, but so towns will gradually get retaken. It might not be... They said events only start when a player encounters it for the first time, so if a zone is left well alone for a while, the next event won't start until another player triggers it. So it's not like the world's going to constantly be in flux. It's always involved with players. So that's one of the biggest things they did, and to do that in a persistent world is pretty huge. I know you played Asheron's Call, Nick, and yeah. You know, they would do things like that.
Yeah, they did. They did a lot of big world changing events in that.
So it's pretty cool, and I like the way they handle getting it back to a state so that all players can still experience the type of content. I brought up that it kind of helps avoid the World of Warcraft problem where the entire game is spoiled by data miners and websites telling you strategies and everything. So if you're not sure what to... Because one event doesn't necessarily mean the next event's going to happen the exact same way. You can't always anticipate everything. So that was pretty cool. And the other thing they did was they changed it so your character creation is a lot more role-playing oriented. When we had our hands on, we saw a little bit of it. But when you create your character, it basically does like the old Ultima trick of asking you a bunch of questions about your guy, and the story that your character experiences throughout the game is actually affected by the things that you say. I played a Norn, which is kind of like a Nordic race, and they're very shamanistic. They worship spirits, and they were saying that depending on which spirit you pick, your character might have different traits, or you know, all the quests are fully voiced, and there really aren't traditional quests. Like there might be a go pick up these three things and bring them back to me, but most of the questing in the game is done through the dynamic event system, which I talked about. So you're very rarely put in a situation where you're going to have to go collect X number of widgets and bring it back and we'll give you a cookie for it. that was basically how they described it.
Yeah.
It's like, so you're rewarded on the spot for heroic deeds. It adds to your character. And the other big thing is the way they changed combat. And if you've ever played an MMO, you know you maneuver yourself into whatever position your class dictates. So if you're a melee fighter, you'll go, say I'm a rogue, I'm gonna want to backstab guys. So this guy's focused on someone else, I'm gonna walk behind him and I'm gonna backstab him. I'm gonna stay behind him as long as I can. So what Guild Wars 2 does is they made it so that there's a lot of motion to your combat. There are, like, a thief character might, like, they might dash in, perform a few precise strikes, and then dash back out of combat, circle around, and wait for a new opportunity to present itself. So you're not always actively doing things. One of the other big changes is that you can actually manually dodge. So an incoming attack aimed at you, if you maneuver yourself out of the way, it won't hit you. So that was really cool. And games like Age of Conan tried something similar, but with limited success. But definitely with what I've played of Guild Wars 2, it worked really well. And the other thing, and they really stressed this as a cooperative element, and it's a wonderful decision, is there is no kill stealing in the game. Every act in the game is cooperative. Ties once again into their dynamic system. So everybody is cooperating to meet this one goal. If you don't work together, you fail. if you're out in the world and you're killing an, you see a rare enemy and you're like, I'm going to go kill that. Some other guy pops out, wants to kill it too. You both take the guy down and you're both rewarded with what loot might drop. So it encourages you, rather than in something like World of Warcraft where you'll see a guy trying to kill a monster you need for your quest, you're like, wow, now I can't do my quest because this guy killed all those monsters in the area. Well, in Guild Wars 2, you can run up and help him kill everything and get the same credit. So they've done a lot for it. They've done a lot for role-playing. They've definitely done a lot for cooperative play in an MMO. And it's shot pretty far up my must-play list. It doesn't sound like it's going to come out this year, but it might. But it's looking pretty much like it's probably going to be coming out next spring, I'd say.
Hopefully we'll get a beta of it. I know the first Guild Wars had a pretty extensive beta time, mm-hmm. so it'd be so nice.
It was pretty great.
Yeah, I played a bit of it. We went to a little preview event, and I got to play like a warrior class. And it just felt like you were doing a lot more than you do a lot of times in MMOs, where you're just, you know, pressing 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, kind mm-hmm. of, you know, pressing your keys and stuff. And those special kind of quests, those group quests that Mike was talking about, the world things, events that were happening, they were pretty epic. The one that I had, it was just like he was describing. There was a town that was under attack, and we were trying to fight back guys, and there were big bosses spawning in, and people were running to help out, and the warrior had one maneuver that I really liked with, if you used a hammer weapon, you could kind of hit a guy up in the air, and your friends could come in and attack him as well, and the combat was definitely satisfying, so that's a good thing.
I think playing Guild Wars 2's combat made almost every other MMO I've played feel primitive. By comparison, it truly sets itself apart the same way the first Guild Wars set itself apart from other online games at the time. So I think they're doing a really good job, and they said that they're going to use the exact same model they used for the original. So you buy the box game and you get everything until they release another, you know, box game like mm-hmm. Like they do with the original. There's going to be some microtransaction, but they were saying pretty much everything they would set a microtransaction for is purely convenience, and there will always be a way to earn it without paying money. So
that's good to hear.
Yeah, it's gonna. I think it's gonna do a lot of good for them.
Awesome. So what else? Let's talk about the 3DS, because the 3DS was here, and with it a couple weeks away, it should be, you know, on everyone's mind that's mildly interested in it. And I know Kat really wanted to check it out because she's got some kind of deformed eye or something like that. And she can't see 3D with glasses. So she was hoping that, you know, she could see what all the fuss was about with 3DS. And so the question is, Kat, could you see 3D?
I could see 3D. the way they described it basically was, it was like any of the cards that you would play with that change images as you tip it.
It's lenticular.
Thanks. yeah, the lens is basically pointed one at each eye, as long as you were looking straight at it. If you were looking at it from an angle, it looked awful. But if you were looking straight at it, the 3D really stood out. You could tell what was going on. But you could also change the depth of it. So if you had any issues with headaches or just wanting to turn it off to save the battery life, there was a little sliding knob on the side that just basically let you adjust how deep the 3D was, or just completely turn it off. The guy that I talked to did not know what the battery life was like at all, but he did mention that the 3D is very likely to drain it pretty fast. So while you're at home, 3D. While you're on the road, maybe not 3D or less 3D. So
yeah, what we had tried to, you know, like you said, you had to be pretty much straight on, and if you look over somebody's shoulder, like, it was just,
it was bad.
It was impossible. But as soon as you put that slider all the way down, it was fine. So it was definitely...
Yeah, and if you turned it off, it was just like a normal game. They just took the lenticular lens out of it. I don't know, like slid it flat or something. Yeah. So
And the other thing I think we were talking about today was the build quality of it was really nice. while like the traditional the 3 the DS and the DSi kind of had almost a plasticky rubbery feel, this was kind of like a metallic, like a heavy duty,
but it was still really thin and really light. So it was really nice. But it did feel a lot more solid than the other ones.
And you played, I think, one of the only co-op games that we know of for the system is the Resident Evil 5, or Resident Evil Mercenaries,
right.
3D or something. I think that's the title.
They had the Wi-Fi off at the show, which was too bad, so I didn't get to actually play with anybody, but it was Mercenaries mode from Resident Evil 5, very much so. The four characters that they had unlocked were Chris, Claire, Honk, and the crazy big guy, like Craven or something, I forget his name. But each of them had their own individual weapons when they start the game. You could pick up things like grenades and time bonuses and the standard stuff. But one of the things that was really nice is the way that you had the hotkeys in the Xbox or PS3 version on the D-pad, you could just tap the screen. So you could see what you were looking for. It's like, oh, I need the sniper rifle right now. So you just tap the screen really fast, and you're holding the sniper rifle. And it worked really well. It was really fluid. And it didn't seem very awkward to take your hands off the buttons and hit the touch screen, which was nice. I thought that might be a problem, but it wasn't.
So I guess I have one question. You both played with the 3DS. So as a left-handed person, The DS was great because the cross pad, the D-pad on the left, and the button arrangement were mirror images of each other. So if you wanted to play a game left-handed, you could use the buttons on the right hand on your right hand as a D-pad. With the slider mechanism in place of the D-pad, at least in position, do you think I'm going to have an issue with this system? Because I've heard games like Kid Icarus require analog and shoulder button usage and tapping the screen.
I played the game, and you didn't really require movement on the touch screen, so I had no problem controlling it normally. Like with the analog stick makes it much easier than, you know, the other 3DS and trying to finesse with the D-pad and stuff.
But I guess what I'm saying is that the slider's on the left hand, so if I'm holding my stylus, I can't use it. Do you think it's going to be an issue?
It might be, yeah. I mean, since they changed it to be analog control with that, I guess depending on the game. See, I would think that the analog control replaces using the touchscreen as an analog input mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be one or the other.
And I didn't actually see a stylus with mine. I used my thumb.
I mean, I'm sure there is one in it. Actually, I think it's actually a really nice one. I think it's one of the ones that's like
a telescope.
But yeah, I mean, I see your point. But I think what we're going to see is that games designed for analog control are going to use that analog stick and getting away from making players put their hand onto that touch screen there to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cool. The effect is nice. It's nothing mind blowing. This is probably a good transition into one that we me and Mike were both impressed with. We saw Fable 3 in 3D
on
the PC, and it was
beautiful.
It was really nice looking. It was like looking at a diorama or something.
The characters looked like they almost looked like action figures.
Yeah.
Like, really detailed action figures. And it was, the depth of field was nice. Everything, you know, something that was supposed to be really close to you looked like it was really close to you. It was probably one of the best 3D effects I've ever seen. It's, you know, except in certain situations when it kind of desynchronized when the camera started moving around a lot. But it was pretty amazing. But the thing is, I don't really feel like it was cool to look at, but I'm not convinced that this type of 3D is something that games need. Like,
yeah, I don't know what it really adds to the experience other than like, yeah, nice. It's you know, it's neat and it's something different. You know, we had said this actually at dinner tonight that most 3D up to this point is first-person shooters. That's what gets showed off. So I think what was nice about this was it was a different kind of game, and it showcased, the detail that can be in 3D when it's not like some crazy fast-moving whatever.
Yeah, I'll tell you what was most impressive were when you would do the sword flourishes, like you'd swing your sword and like stab a guy through, like you'd run him through from behind. It would do the slow motion pan. That was really impressive. The blood spray looked like it was flying out at you. Yeah. It was pretty cool.
So, let's talk about another game I think that is up on all of our radars now after playing it. And that's a game called Bastion.
Yes.
And it's, what's the studio's name?
Supergiant Games.
Okay.
It's a very small studio.
Yeah, there's six guys in it. And it's a 2D...
Isometric action RPG.
But what's unique about it is the entire game is narrated. All your actions are narrated, the story's narrated and stuff, from little things of like picking up a potion and filling it with water and drinking it to, how you're attacking guys and I never did get to see what they said when I fell off the level, because apparently I busted
you
that.
Did it. Well, you did it while he was in dialogue, but yeah. Basically like Nick said, everything you do is narrated. So if you fall off of the world as it's building around you, the narrator will say something goofy like, "Oh, and the kid needed to watch his step." And then you respawn on the world and you're just kind of giggling at how clever and how engaging that is. It's like, "Oops, I fell." And he reminds you that, oops, you fell,
My personal favorite, I think the best part about all this is we all played the same demo, but we all got different narration for things.
Yep.
So I fell off the level, and the narrator said, "And then the boy fell to his death." Ah, just kidding. And it responds to you right as he says it.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really funny. It seemed like they picked some incredibly specific things. Like my favorite example of the whole thing was I used a super move to kill a boss, and the narrator said, "Oh, that's a hell of a time to run out of your whatever the energy was." He says, "At least you killed that guy." So it's really good, and it's got because it's such a small studio, it's got such a strong art style. I've described it in the preview we put up on the site as it basically looks like someone played Legend of Mana and said, "Whoa, I really like this art style," and they built a whole game around it, and it looks really great. It just feels like an indie game. Like indie games always have a very specific feel to them. It's not like it's a lack of polish. It's different enough from what most other games are, and when I played it, I knew I was playing something special, and you don't really get that feeling when you play a lot of games, especially when you play a high volume of games like we all do.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the neat things about it was, despite it, and we're still trying to actually figure this out, because it does a good job if it is actually a 3D game, in that a lot of the world is destructible. And, you can hit your way through piles of rocks and stuff, and you can break crates and walls, and I think there's a part where you're in a bar and there's tables and stuff you can break in there. So it does it's very interactive as well. It's not just the narration that makes it special, and the first moments of the game starts, it's just beautiful. It's like the boy wakes up and he talks about the world building around him. As you're walking, you're seeing the pieces of the world form and you're just walking around, and it has this epic feeling right from the beginning. You're like, mm-hmm. Okay, this is going to be cool. I know it's going to be cool. And yeah. The timing and everything of it is just perfect right from the get-go. So,
and the controls feel really good. You're a lot more limber than you might think you are in a game of that type. Yeah, you can jump around. You have both melee and ranged. I think my personal favorite bit that I played was when you get the bow and arrow, and it operates basically like the torque bow in Gears of War, except from an isometric perspective. And thankfully, there's a little bit of auto lock on, for the ranged attacks. So you start firing the state gun or whatever the hell it was, and it'll pick the closest target and target it, unless you're manually trying to aim it. And it'll do the same for when you're using the bow. You'll see it pinpoint an enemy, and you can kind of circle strafe around them or aim at a new target.
Yeah.
But it was really fun, and it's coming out. Sounded like they're saying it's going to come out later in the summer.
Yeah, and this could be PC and XBLA, I believe.
Yeah.
So
it was demoed on a PC.
Yeah.
So it played really well, and it has 360 controller support.
Yeah.
On the PC, so
definitely keep an eye on that one. It's gonna be something special later this year. Another beautiful game that we all kind of saw, but none of us played, was Child of Eden.
Yes.
Which is Rez. It's the best way to describe it. It's really, really pretty Rez. It's the Kinect game. They had it on a huge stage with a really, really big screen, and only one person was going up and playing at a time. But I think all of us kind of, as we passed it, stopped and just admired it and watched it. And
it's basically like, you know, Rez at least had some semblance of you being a character in a world and, you know, roaming through. And this was basically like a Winamp visualization with things to shoot. And they've always, they've talked a lot about being the spiritual successor to Rez, but I think it's the sequel to Rez, because it used the same sound effects for, like, doing your targeting and things like that. It's so similar. And that is by no means a bad thing. Rez is one of my absolute favorite games of all time. And to have it finally get a true sequel or spiritual successor is pretty great.
So changing complete gears and going to something Kat called me excitedly about yesterday. I said, you have to get over here and get some pictures of this, is Fear 3. It's a game we already knew that was being designed around co-op for a campaign, but they've actually added a co-op survival mode, and they've changed the formula a bit of it, and it's called Fucking Run. That is the name of the survival mode. Kat, maybe you want to tell us exactly how it works.
Basically, the whole purpose of the mode is to fucking run. I mean, you start off in a little, like, loadout area where you're talking to your buddies, you're kind of coordinating, everybody gets to pick their weapons and stuff, and then you activate the level, and you are walking through the ruined streets of the Fear world with the ghost soldiers and stuff hanging around and shooting you and your buddies, but the big kind of difference between this survival mode and other survival modes is the wall of death that is chasing you down. Basically, you have a limited amount of time to clear an area and to book it. If anybody in your group falls down, you have to res them. If they die, it's over. You have failed the survival. So everybody really has to work together. They have to stick together. Everybody has to communicate and say, hey guys, I'm struggling, or I'm falling behind, or I'm down, or something like that, so that you can be rezzed quickly, otherwise you'll fail pretty fast.
And the wall of death is impressive in itself, and if you ever saw The Mummy, and what it looks like coming out of the sand, you know, in that one scene, that's kind of what this was. Apparently it's Alma chasing everybody down, and it's just this giant cloud of this coming at you, and it's watching people play and stuff, it's definitely tense. I think Kat is still hurt, her wrist from trying to run, hold down the run button and stuff. And we were all pleasantly surprised, and it's good to see them adding more co-op to that game.
Something that the developer I was talking to pointed out is that the way they've designed the level is that, in addition to it being crazy frantic, is they've actually added some very risk versus reward scenarios. Like, there'll be an alternate path that you can take that's actually a dead end, but you can get more powerful weapons by going down to the end of it.
Oh, interesting.
But if someone decides to go that way, they run risk of being caught by the wall. So, yeah, you really have to know what you're doing. You really have to coordinate. And, you know, I think maybe it was just this developer, but he was so insanely proud that they called this mode fucking Run. He's telling me that he wanted to get every video interview he could and just repeatedly refer to it by its name, say it and take 10 seconds to say fuck. And it's just like, you know, it was pretty fun, and it is kind of a white knuckle mode. You really, like, if you fall down, you are screwing the team. You can't just play it like you would any other team based shooter, where you run in, you die, you respawn.
Yeah.
You don't worry about hiding. But the trick is, you know, even though there's a cover system in the game, you can't really take cover, because taking cover takes time, and taking time kills you.
Yeah.
So everyone has to be on point. Everyone has to be playing at the top of their game, and I don't think I saw anyone finish that level.
Yeah.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else do we see? We still got a couple of good ones. Trenched was a Xbox Live Arcade game that we got to see yesterday. And that's the Double Fine game. It's set in an alternate World War One where players control these giant mechs that are basically a walking trench, which where the game gets its name from. It's got the sandbags at the top, and you see a little person there and stuff. And if you have this gun, but it's the trick of it is it's actually a kind of a tower defense game where you get direct control of a person and. From what I could see, it looked pretty different. It looked a lot more intense than typical tower defense games are, a lot more interactive. The big thing is it's got 4-player co-op, and that's through all the campaigns in the game. The players, as you do stuff and you pick up the in-game money, you can customize your mech and stuff, and that's a big thing, so you can kind of show off your mech and your friends' games and stuff like that. I don't know if you have anything to say about it. You're the one that actually got to play it.
Yeah, if I could compare it to any game that we already see a lot of co-op in, it would be Monday Night Combat on a larger scale, a much larger scale. But you'll have a lot of defending missions. You're supposed to defend certain buildings or vehicles or whatever is around you. They also had Team Res, which, like, someone goes down and they're hanging out for a while. You don't bleed out, which is really nice, because sometimes you get a little overwhelmed by all of the insanity around. But you can sit there and still shoot and just kind of hang out and wait for your buddies, but it's definitely a very co-op mode. And if not everybody's working on it, you can be overwhelmed, so...
So yeah, that's looking pretty good, and Double Fine's been...
on fire.
Yeah, they've been churning out some good stuff lately. So, I think they said that that's going to be a summer game, and we should be seeing more from that for sure. What else? Today we also saw Firefall from Red 5 Studios.
We did.
And Mike, you can sum it up in one sentence.
Yo, this is Tribes.
And that's basically it. We actually got to talk to... one of the lead developers on the game, who happened to be a lead developer on both Tribes and Tribes 2. And it's very apparent.
And Firefall, what they're showing off, and while I was playing the Team Deathmatch mode that they were showing off at PAX, Nick was performing an interview behind me. So Nick can probably fill you in more on details about the campaign and stuff, but... the Team Deathmatch mode I played was really fun. It plays so much like Tribes, even down to, you know, using a way station to pick your armor loadout and class role. Everyone has jetpacks. There's a pretty cool medic class I really enjoyed playing. It works a little bit like the Team Fortress one, but you have a little bit more offensive capability. Each class has 3 abilities that can be triggered. They work on cooldown, so like the assault classes can be, they can kick their weapon into overdrive and increase their fire rate a whole bunch. They can leap into the air and then chain that into a crater mode where you actually, you know, ram the ground and hit enemies with a big AoE and knock them away. It was really cool that when you kill a guy and they go down, they're still kind of crawling around, but they kind of adopted the Gears of War curb stomp. So when an enemy's crawling around, you can go up to them and you have to hold the E key and you'll curb stomp them. But while you're in that animation, you're vulnerable. So it worked pretty well. Played fast and loose. The weapons worked really well. The armor abilities were pretty great. But, you know, I wish they were showing up the co-op mode, because a team deathmatch mode is a team deathmatch. But I'll tell you, this feels more like Tribes than any game I've played since then, even ones that claim they took inspiration from it. And obviously, the pedigree is there.
Yeah, definitely.
And the art style is really strong. It seems like it's going to run on pretty much anything, the way the engine looked. It was actually... The art style looks really good. The game's really beautiful, but it's actually very low polygon. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you were looking at it, but they took kind of the Blizzard approach, and it makes sense because a lot of these guys are ex-Blizzard. They use the strength of their art style to overcome what they would have to do technically to make it look that good. So I was pretty pleased. And why don't you tell us a bit more about what you interviewed?
Yeah, so obviously since they were showing off Versus, I still had to get some of the co-op info out of them. So, you know, he had told us that your characters that you create are persistent no matter what mode you decide to play in. So whatever you earn and unlock for... your character class, you can play that in the co-op modes and stuff like that, which is good to hear. Trying to think what else he kind of said. That, you know, he said the big focus of the game, it's going to be split. It's like the story to them is as important as the team deathmatch kind of stuff and the customization. It sounds like player customization is going to be huge. There's going to be kind of a army system, I think is what he called it.
Yeah.
And that players can create their own armies, which, you know, teams of players, basically a guild. And there's, whether you're playing Versus, you can kind of have competitions and stuff. And they actually added a spectator mode with, like, this whole crazy little scoreboard thing and stuff for people to watch. But you can also, you know, group up and go complete quests and stuff like that together. So it's definitely looking to shape up pretty well. It sounds like they're at a point now where they know exactly what they want to do. They're just kind of wrapping it up and getting close to a beta test.
They did say they're still aiming at getting it out this year, and
that's good.
I tell you, it handled like a it handled like a finished game. So if they're just working on content now, then you know it's probably pretty close.
Let's see a few other things, little ones. I guess the last big one, co-op wise, is Dungeons and Dragons Daggerdale, which is basically your Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance.
Sorry, I'm trying to go back.
So it's a full D&D game. I think they said they used Rule Set 4 mm-hmm. as the base, except they changed some rules. They were like, yeah, apparently in Rule Set 4, wizards can only cast one spell a day. So they kind of change that. There's four characters in the game you can pick from. It's not that you create your own character. You choose from... I do have my notes here. Let's see. So there's
a fighter, a cleric, a rogue, and
yes, but they're specific ones. There is a human fighter, an elven rogue, a dwarven cleric, and a halfling wizard. So those are the four characters that are part of the story. This game is one of three, actually, and it's going to focus on levels 1 through 10. The big standout feature that they have is a randomly generated loot system. They said they have somewhere over 1 billion items within the game that you can pick up and enhance your character with. The other thing that they took from the D&D 4 rule set is the feats system.
Yeah.
So, like, you can specialize in two-handed weapons, or you can specialize in, you know, it might be something where it gives you health back for doing a certain amount of damage and stuff like that. So there's a whole big list of these feats that you can choose from, and you can earn abilities from that. The other thing I really liked was, despite it being a console arcade title, and, you know, you're limited by your four buttons there as for casting things. So by default, your four buttons, there was like one for health potion and ranged attack and melee attack and interaction. and then you hold a trigger to do your special abilities. They actually said, you know, you can earn a bunch of abilities in the game. You might have 8 or 10 abilities. If you want to map those main buttons to ability buttons, you can do that, and to basically take away your normal attack and your normal ranged attack and make it just spells and stuff if you wanted to do that.
And one of the other big things is that all of your moves can combo. So you can do like a 3-hit combo and then chain it into a special move.
Yeah.
So I was playing the fighter, so I do like 3 normal hits, chain it into like a slashing move, and then finish off with a shield bash. So it played pretty well.
Yeah, and it looked pretty good too. For co-op players, it's going to have 2-player local co-op and 4-player online co-op. Obviously your character is persistent, so you can bring that character, you know, whatever you're doing offline, you can bring them online and play with friends and stuff like that. They said the game's pretty replayable as well, obviously, until you max out your guy. Then it basically just becomes about finding good loot and stuff. Because it is going to have those other games after it, your character is something that you can bring along to the other games afterwards when those come out. So I really liked it. Mike and I have actually been talking about Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance
for like 2 weeks
now. Yeah, I don't know why. Somehow we got on this subject, and Mike's been saying he has to pick it up, and then it was like...
Pick it up again.
Yeah.
Because I played it and beat it when it came out, and then I traded it in or otherwise got rid of it.
But, yeah, so it basically comes down to, if you like those style of games, you're really going to like Daggerdale. It's going to be a $10 downloadable, or, well, $10 or $15 downloadable title on XBLA, PSN, and PC. And they're targeting spring. They want to give a specific date yet.
I was told late spring.
Late spring. So yeah,
so before E3.
Yeah,
I guess.
So then there's just a... Well, actually, no. There is one other one, and that's Slambolt Scrappers, which Kat saw today.
He did. The studio had shown a pretty early build of Slambolt Scrappers last year at PAX, and I enjoyed it, though I was terrible at it. It's basically kind of a beat-em-up, but it's got Tetris elements. Like, basically, there's a bunch of little flying monster things, and your character can fly up to those monsters, beat the crap out of them, and get a brick of some sort in some shape. And you have to drop it and build turrets to attack another base. And the way that works is you have to attack and build without dying, without being knocked out of the game, or without them knocking down your tower. If your tower is gone, it's over. And basically, the way the co-op is going to work is, it sounds like it's going to be a comp stomp. They actually didn't let us play it, but it'll be basically 2 players against 2 AI, or 3 players against 1 AI, or something like that. And it works through the storyline, and you'll be helping each other out. Each team is a different color, or each group is. And you'll work together to build turrets of the same color and just take out the other guys. And it seems really simplistic. It's the first time you play it, it's really difficult, and the second time it's so much easier. Like, the learning curve is basically one level or one game, and you pick it up and basically run with it as it goes, and it's pretty addictive. It's a lot of fun.
Cool. And it's out Tuesday actually.
Yeah, so it'll be out really soon.
Probably by the time this podcast goes up, it'll be out already, so that should be pretty interesting. And then, yeah, just a few other little things. We had tried out a game called Swarm this morning, which is, it's like a Lemmings platformer, I guess is the best way to describe it, in that you control this giant swarm of little blue dudes, and you gotta run and jump and collect other things, and you get more blue dudes. But it was very kind of environmental based, like puzzles, like the floors would collapse underneath you, there'd be big areas that would open up and you'd have to jump over and stuff like that.
It was actually pretty tough.
Yeah, it was very tough, especially when you looked at the freaking high score that was posted on the machine, and we got like 1/9 of it. We weren't even close to how that, you know, those people were doing. So what else? We have Fez on the list, which was a unique looking title. It was kind of a, I guess it's a puzzle game in a sense, or a kind of a platformer.
It's a bit of a puzzle platformer. Basically, If you ever played Super Paper Mario on the Wii, you could rotate the world to do certain things. This takes it a step beyond, where you actually pan the world completely 360 degrees, but, you know, 90 degrees at a time. So, you know, things will, there'll be like a building you're trying to scale. There'll be four sides to it, and you'll be, you might climb onto something and then stand on it, and then when you rotate it, you're sitting inside of a tunnel. You walk down the tunnel and then rotate the world again. Then now you're on the side of a wall and can start climbing up. I didn't get any hands-on with it because there was a pretty big line, but it's been in development for at least 2 or 3 years. I know I've seen it. I know I'd seen of it at least before PAX 08. So it's been a long time coming, but it looks fantastic.
What else? You also saw some of the Serious Sam indie games that are coming.
Yeah, I did. I saw one, and I hope I don't butcher the title, but I saw it was Kamikaze Rush. You basically play as one of the guys with the bomb hands, and it's kind of a... It works on PC, but it's intended for Android and iPhone. It's basically kind of like Cannibal. It's one of those auto runners. You run from left to right. You have a jump button and a kick button, and basically how it works is Serious Sam is firing rockets or bombs at you, and you have to punt them out of the way so you can progress through the level. So you'll like kick a rocket, and you're basically like jump kicking rockets, and your guy is doing the whole time. And the longer that you hold down your like attack button, because you'll get like a double jump, and if you're attacking, you'll kind of glide through the air. There's a little meter. If you hold it too long, you detonate. So you roll through the level and kick the bombs and kick the missiles back. And eventually, once you clear objectives, because it'll be like kick 15 missiles, kick 25 bombs, and then you go to a boss stage where it's actually you running after Serious Sam, and he's firing these things at you, and you use the same mechanics and you kick them. You kick them back and try and kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting about this one is the guy's name is Brad, and I didn't catch his last name, but he is actually an ex-Crystal Dynamics guy who worked on Lara Croft Guardian of Light, left to set out to do his own thing. So it's simple, it's fun, but I think it's pretty funny, and I think it'll do pretty well.
Yeah, it's interesting that Crow Team and... Devolver Digital did with the new Serious Sam that's coming out is they got a couple independent developers together, basically gave them free reign with the IP, and had them create some games, and one of them was this game, and there's one from Mommy's Best Games who's done Shoot One Up, which is a game we really enjoyed. It's a 2D platformer. And there's another one that's actually a turn-based RPG set in the Serious Sam universe. So it'll be interesting to see how those turn out. And they, you know, they plan to have all those games out before the game actually releases and stuff like that. But that's definite props to Crow Team and stuff over there for doing something different and a different way to promote their product and stuff.
It was fun, and I'll definitely recommend checking it out when it eventually releases.
Real quick, you had mentioned there's a new expansion for Ion that you got to
there check is, out. And I still can't remember what it was called because I didn't write it down.
And we don't have internet.
But one of the big things they were talking about is improvements they made through the last expansion towards Ion's solo ability and the fact that there were large gaps in the content. So you'd run out of quests to do, and you'd have 3 levels before you could take on another quest, and it was really grind-heavy and horrible. But really what the new expansion does is adds a lot of stuff for the guild system, I think. So you can, you know, there's a lot of challenges. The biggest thing is there's 2 new instances, and there's actually a big, huge open world instance which has a lot of bosses and areas to visit, but they implemented a crazy arena battle instance where it's 10 stages with 5 sub-stages each, and it's so it'll be like you fight a boss. It'll be like stage 1-1, you fight a boss, you kill a boss. Stage 1-2, fight another boss, and this goes on until stage 10-5.
Jeez.
And the level is constantly transforming, so it's like you start inside like this stone enclosure, you fight a boss, and then some attack blows the walls off the stone enclosure. Now all of a sudden you're like flying through the air, being carried by like an airship, and you're fighting on that. Then the airship will crash and you'll end up on a you'll end up in the water and the ship will be sinking. So you'll be fighting while it's sinking. You'll end up in the bottom of the ocean. It's like flying everywhere. It looked completely insane.
Huh.
And what they're saying is that you'll lose the dungeon, but the loot you're awarded comes based on how far you made it. So if you make it a few stages in, you'll get this type of loot. If you make it further, you get better loot, and so on until the very end. And he actually said that in between the boss fights, they have mini games. So there'll be like a miniature tower defense game in between the boss fights. There'll be like the one example he gave that was more concrete is like a portal will open and then a bunch of these little guys will start marching out and there'll be another portal that they're trying to get to. So the goal is to kill all of them before they hit to the other portal. So it seems really kind of wacky and interesting, but the level looked insane. One of the other big things is they actually completely rewrote the game engine. And like other MMOs that have had a graphical upgrade in the past, it's actually optional. And an option in the olden days, you could like hop your video card down to like DirectX 8 instead of 9 to increase performance. This is essentially the same thing. It's like, let's turn on multiple light sources. Let's turn on different types of shading and HDR and things.
Wasn't Ion already like a really pretty?
It was already really pretty, and they decided it wasn't pretty enough. It looked flat out gorgeous. That's cool. The art direction in that game was one of the reasons I played it as long as I did, especially when I ran into that wall. And it looked pretty sweet. And after talking to the NCSoft guy, I'm actually considering hopping back in and checking a lot of the changes out, because it was a really, really cool game. It just had a lot of problems. Yeah. And it seems to be a common NCSoft thing. Like outside of ArenaNet, which is based in the U.S., all of their games really tend to come from Korea, so they have to localize these MMOs, so they can't always get everything right for a launch, because they have a certain window they gotta hit, and if they're working through translators, it's never gonna be as fast as it needs to be.
Yeah. So finally, we're gonna wrap things up with an interesting game, and this is Cat's Find.
On accident.
It is a game and it isn't a game, and it's called something. It's something called Game Book Adventures.
Yep.
Why don't you tell us what that is?
Basically, I was walking around the indie part of the game floor, and all I heard out of the chaos was basically, "Do you like choose your own adventure books?" And I turned around instantly, and I was like, "Yes, please," because the guy was just kind of pitching it to someone else, and I kind of interrupted. But basically, this small studio out of Australia created this iPhone, iPod Touch, iPad choose your own adventure book that has RPG elements. Basically, you build a character to begin with, you roll dice to randomize how your player is, and you make decisions through a storybook. You're just reading, and it's like, if you make this decision, turn to page 48. If you make another decision, turn to 193, and you can set bookmarks in the pages instead of where you would sit there with all of your fingers holding where you were, so you could go back to change a decision if you made a really poor one. But basically, everything you do affects your character in the book. So I actually went back to my hotel last night and purchased it, because it just seemed so interesting. And the first part of the first book, you're basically in a bar, and you get three choices at the end of the little section. You can either buy another beer, leave the bar, or start a fight with the bartender. And my first decision was to just drink another beer, just kind of hang out and do whatever. And after drinking my second beer, or however many the character had had before that, It dropped my vitality a little bit because I was inebriated and I couldn't figure things out. And then immediately after you walk out of the bar, you get into a fight and you have to roll dice to see if you survive or whatever it is. And there are five books in, like, I'm really ashamed that I hadn't found this earlier, but they've got five full novel-length choose-your-own-adventure book games, basically for iPod, iPhone, iPad, all that good stuff. But we did talk to the developer about moving it to other platforms, and they want to put it on PC and Android at some point. So just moving it over.
We talked to two different guys. Yeah. The one I spoke to not only mentioned that, but he was looking at getting it on the Kindles.
Oh, that's right. All the e-readers.
Yeah.
Another goal.
So one of the cool things that they did with this is they understand that gamers like unlockables. So they have, there's a couple things they have. And all these novels take place in one world. So they have a world encyclopedia. So you could actually look up information about stuff, kind of its own little thing. As any good Choose Your Own Adventure book has, there's illustrations everywhere. And as you come across illustrations, it actually unlocks it in, like, a concept art section. And there was an achievement or badge system. So for doing, like you do this specific thing in the game, it'll give you an award. And you can take a look and see what you missed. So you might actually replay it and choose a different path to try and achieve those goals. So they made a game out of forcing you to read a book, which is pretty awesome if you ask me. And one of the other advantages, they said, especially now since they're currently only on iPhone, iPad, is they can push updates to the App Store whenever.
Yep.
And it makes a lot of sense. So say they come up with a sixth book. The sixth book adds a bunch of new locations, a bunch of history, so all of the other games get retroactively upgraded with the new encyclopedia to reference this new content from the other book. And it is really well thought out, and I felt so bad for these guys being tucked into the small corner they were in, because
it was really literally in the corner. It was pretty bad.
Like, I went looking for it after Kat talked about it. I was like, I love this stuff. I have to see it. And I found them, and they were there. They were really eager to show off everything, and I think Kat felt this too. It was like they were really happy someone was looking at what they had. And there were a few the way the show floor was is there were some areas where, like, the 3DS had a bunch of stuff around it, but the line basically made it so that the people in line could essentially block booths, which was pretty unfortunate. And these guys were behind a lot of the indie guys were behind the PC hardware vendors
who were stopping people constantly in the aisle. So it's like, oh, look, I can't go forward anymore.
Yeah, so they were tucked way back in the corner, and I'm glad I went back, because this was one of the most unique things I'd seen in a while. As someone who, A, liked Choose Your Own Adventure, B, likes RPGs and D&D, and C, really likes adventure games, because this worked kind of like an adventure game. Like, a Phoenix Wright game, for instance, works almost exactly like this without the stat building.
Yeah.
So, it was pretty cool, and I'm very glad I saw it. I wish I had co-op. It's like players exchange turns reading the words. Every other word. You are going to the bar to drink this beer. All right.
So yeah, so that's PAX East, I guess, our impressions. The show this year, Kat and I went to PAX East last year. It was in a different spot. It's a lot bigger this year. The convention center it's in is redonkulous.
Yeah,
in size, it is
bigger. The show floor is bigger than the ones at PAX Prime.
Yeah, easy. Which is nice, because the aisles are really wide, and they very rarely got clogged up. The only time you were getting slow with things is when people decided to stop and look at the shiny objects, basically in the middle of the thing.
The worst was when one of the Riot Games guys started handing out League of Legends swag away from his booth in the middle of a walkway. I was like, what are you doing, dude?
But yeah, so So that's the good of it. The bad of it, the area of town it's in is kind of away from everything, and it spaces kind of the community out. So once you get away from the convention, it's kind of, you're kind of isolated.
It's sad.
Well, we're trapped in the financial district of Boston, and luckily tonight, if we all sound a little sloppy, we went to an Irish pub before showing up here.
Yeah.
To record this and got our Boston on. But yeah, it's like there's no real like restaurants.
Yeah.
Everyone's pretty much confined to their hotels or wherever they came from. So if I could have one wish, it would be, something simple to go run out and eat.
Yeah.
Rather than having to, get lost on Google Maps trying to find something in an unfamiliar town.
But all right, I think that's it. We've eaten an hour and a half of your time, and but we'll be back in 2 weeks with a normal Co-opticast. And so yeah, this is, I don't know what episode this is. We won't get it on the road.
60 something.
Yeah, it's the PAX East special. I am Nick. That's Mike.
Okay.
Thanks for listening. Forget about